Hi, and welcome to Organic Thinking Radio. I'm Michelle, and this is Healthy Food for Your Mind. Today, we'll be talking about shamanism. My guest today is Don Cameron. Don is a shamanic energy healer who lives right here on Cape Cod. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you, Michelle.
So today, we're talking about shamanism. Can you explain to us what a shaman is, and what do shamans traditionally do?
Sure. Well, shamans are the medicine men and women of many traditional cultures all around the world. And their main function really is healing. They were the original doctors, if you like, before there was modern medicine. They've also done other things traditionally. They've been called the travelers in space and time. And by that, what I mean is, for example, in the Native American culture, the shaman would also have the responsibility of telling the hunters where the buffalo were going to be tomorrow morning, so that when they went out there, they'd actually find the buffalo. And in the South Pacific, similarly, the shaman would have the responsibility of telling the fishermen where the fish were going to be tomorrow morning, so they could find them. And if that sounds a little far out, imagine if you were one of these shamans and you screwed up a couple of times, so the hunters or the fishermen came back empty-handed, you probably wouldn't have your job much longer. So it seems that they were able to do that. They were also the navigators back in ancient times, traveling across literally hundreds of miles of uncharted ocean in the Pacific. They also helped the dying cross over. Crossing over between the worlds from this world to the next. And they've also been known to do strange things like shape-shifting. If you ever read the Carlos Castaneda novels or biography, supposedly, back in the 70s, you know what I'm talking about. But healing is the core, and that's what I've been trained in. And it really is an ancient tradition. Shamanism goes back literally tens of thousands of years. It's believed to have started somewhere in Asia, maybe Siberia, maybe the Himalayas. And then from there, it spread down through south, through the down towards the South Pacific and the Philippines, and north and across the Bering Strait to North America, Central America, South America. So it goes back a long way.
Yeah. So the shamans, you see the medicine men of the jungles. That's mm-hmm. what most people think. But
sure.
This has been around for a long time. It's what the basic medicine of the earth.
Yep,
has been.
Exactly. Not just the jungle, but really all over the world.
So what inspired you to walk the path of a shaman?
Well, I need to set the stage a little bit before that. You probably can guess from my accent that I wasn't born here. I was actually born in Scotland, educated in England at Cambridge University, studied science and engineering, had a career in engineering, computer software, both technical and management, and came over here about 40 years ago. So I'm an engineer and computer guy by background, about as far from this kind of thing as you can imagine. Okay. But I always had some kind of what you would call New Age interests, even though New Age is a misnomer. It often refers to new interest in ancient stuff. So, for example, I had a good friend who did some shamanic drumming journeys and a vision quest, and I was interested in that, although I never actually followed it up. I read all the Carlos Castaneda novels, The Mexican Sorcerer Apprentice. Read a lot of Gene Houston's books, The Possible Human, and so on. But on the other side, I've always been kind of a guy who had his feet firmly on the ground. I was pretty skeptical about a lot of the far-out claims, like shape-shifting in the Castaneda novels, for example. So that's the background. As far as my calling, it happened completely unexpectedly. The setting was a nature show called Eyes on Owls, which probably some of the listeners have experienced. Marsha Wilson and her husband Mark have a license to keep rehabilitated owls which have been injured or found as chicks in the wild but weren't able to go back to the wild. So they have a license to keep them, and they fund their efforts by taking the show around. And part of the show is the natural history of the owls. They've got some beautiful photographs and a lot of discussion about how owls hunt and so on. But part of it is that they actually have six or eight owls that they bring with them. And they bring these owls out one at a time, she does, on a gauntleted wrist, on a tether, and walks around the room with them. So you see these beautiful creatures. Some of them are only about 6 inches high. The little saw-whet owl, she says you can fit that in a Coke can if you could persuade it to go in. All the way up to a great horned owl that is about 4 foot wingspan. And as she walks around the room with them, she occasionally wiggles her wrist, and the bird spreads its wings to get its balance. So you see these gorgeous creatures at 6 or 8 feet range. So pretty awe-inspiring. And I was with the rest of the audience, a lot of kids, but also adults. I was pretty interested. And then she brought the snowy owl out. And I'd never seen a snowy owl before, but she started walking around the room with it, beautiful bird. And then she wiggled her wrist and the owl spread its wings. And when it did so, it was like somebody punched me in the gut. Not a physical blow, but equally powerful. It took my breath away. And that had never happened to me before, something that was not in my normal senses, if you like. So I was pretty struck by that, but I was doing other things at the time, so I didn't really follow it up. Except that I went back when I saw her notice in the paper again 3 months later. I decided, well, I'll go back and see if it happens again. She brought the snowy owl out. It spread its wings. Bam, same thing happened. It was kind of like, will you pay attention? That's twice now. So I said, all right, there's something here going on. And I knew enough about shamanism from reading that, you know, I thought maybe this is to do with shamanism. So it happened that I was going on a weekend a couple of weeks later with Jean Houston, as a matter of fact, who knows a lot about this kind of thing. And so I asked her at one of the breaks, I said, Jean, do you think that this means I'm being called to shamanism? And Jean's a very theatrical person. She used to be an actress. So she raised her eyebrows into her hairline, more or less, and said, duh, what else could it mean? So, but she said, you've got to be careful. There are some shaman teachers on the dark side, and you want to make sure you stay away from them. So she put me in touch with Alberto Vialdo, who is the fellow that I actually trained with. And I'll get to the training in a minute, but the third part of that calling is that after I'd really committed to the training, Marcia Wilson came back to the Cape again, and I decided I'd go and see her show a third time, wondering what was going to happen this time. And sure enough, the snowy owl spread its wings, didn't have to hit me in the gut. I'd already committed to the work.
You got the message.
I got the message. Instead, it sort of, I can't really describe it other than to say it was like somebody pouring a warm blanket of acceptance over me. It was like, yeah, you got it. Yep. Yeah, it was really very sweet. And, you know, after this all happened, which, as you can imagine, was a pretty moving experience, all three of them, I did some reading and found out or read up on how the indigenous shamans, especially in Peru, which is the tradition I trained in, how they actually were called typically. And I gather there's like three methods that they can be called. One is they can inherit the capability from a grandfather, father, mother, who was a shaman. That wasn't in my possibility. Secondly, they can be struck by lightning, and if they survive, it's like they get rewired and more susceptible to the kinds of things you've got to do. Well, I was lucky to avoid that one. And the third one is they can be called by a messenger or a Estrella in the local dialect, which is usually an animal or a bird, can be in dreams, can be in real life. So my snowy owl was my Estrella. So this is very normal in shamanic terms. But
they call
pretty,
your power,
pretty strange for me.
Your power animal.
My power animal. One of my power animals. We can all have many power animals. But I guess there's one thing I'd add is that I was never a psychic person or a person with psychic abilities. I think there was perhaps one extrasensory experience in my entire 64 years prior to that. So it's not like I was going around, you know, experiencing all this kind of thing all the time.
And how about having connections to nature or animals? Was it?
Not specifically, no.
Wow.
No, I mean, I've always loved nature, but I'm not a particularly touchy-feely person with animals, except for cats. I love cats.
Okay.
And that ties into jaguars, which is one of the archetypes we'll talk about later in the Peruvian tradition.
Yes. So now that you've been trained and you are a shaman, do you feel that the nature has opened up to you? Do you feel like you have more of a connection to animals? Is it something that kind of bridges you back to the earth?
It certainly bridges one back to the earth, because a lot of the tradition, as I'll get into a little later, is around the connection to Pachamama, or Mother Earth, as the Indians in Peru call her, and also to spirit, which is the upper part, if you like. So yes, one definitely gets a stronger connection to all of that, not specifically to animals, but certainly to nature. Yeah.
Now, you are considered a Western shaman. So what makes that different than, you know, the men that grew up in the jungles of Peru or whatever?
Well, not
the
many
jungles
of
the, in Peru?
Not many of them had backgrounds in computers and engineering.
True.
So there's
or
the
go
first,
to Oxford
that's the
or
first
Cambridge
difference.
Or, yes.
Cambridge, please. Right. Well, I trained in the tradition of the Incas of Peru, as I think I may have mentioned. The shamans there were almost wiped out about 500 years ago when, first of all, the conquistadors came through, and then hot on their heels came the Inquisition. Hmm. And they branded all the female shamans as witches and had them executed. And they branded the male shamans as equally bad, but they couldn't afford to execute them because they needed them in the fields. So they kept them alive, but they stopped them practicing shamanism. So there's just a remnant of that tradition, a very small percentage of the practicing shamans 500 years ago managed to escape, And that remnant is still living, or their descendants are still living in the high Andes about 18,000 feet up. Mm. And they've maintained the tradition over these 500 years in a somewhat tattered form, as it were. But there's a fellow called Alberto Villaldo, who is an anthropologist, and about 25 years ago, 30 years ago, he did some research in Peru and got interested in shamanism and ended up spending a lot of time interviewing and talking to and witnessing the healing that a lot of these native shamans did, and kind of put together a westernized version of the training that they did, because it isn't terribly useful or appropriate for us to go down to Peru to learn everything from scratch, or to go to the jungle and take, you know, mind-altering drugs, which they do, but we don't have to. Mm. And so he really came up with a westernized version, which he teaches from the Four Winds Society in Park City, Utah, and actually around the world. So it's a training program that is about a two-year program. It's about 7 weeks, seven calendar weeks of training spread over these 2 years, with a requirement to do a lot of pro bono sessions with clients over that period in between the classes, which is really the way you learn, by actually doing it and witnessing the healing and getting the feel for it. And it's very hands-on. The whole training is hands-on. There's a lot of opportunity to both practice being a shaman with your fellow students and to experience the effects of the healing with either the trainers or with the fellow students. So it's a fun, very fun training program. But it's not just practical, because obviously there's a lot of concept behind this. I mean, this is pretty strange stuff for us Westerners, especially for engineers and scientists.
I was just thinking, how did your two sides, you know, how did your mind side that you say, wait, what am I doing here? And then your inside is going, no, this makes sense. Like, how long did it take for you to integrate all that?
It took a long time. In fact, my mentor, who was one of the trainers, after I'd completed the training, we were talking about, we were swapping case studies at one point, and she sent me an email afterwards, and she said, Don, that was a wonderful set of case studies you gave me. I just want to tell you that you were probably one of the most vociferously skeptical students I've ever had the privilege of training. So I gave her a hard time, I'm afraid. But the concept behind the shamanic healing is important, I think. It's about, the basic concept is that we all have an energy field that is part of who we really are. In fact, it really is our essence, if you like. And the concept is that as we go through life, that energy field can get dinged or damaged or scratched, just like our physical bodies can. And when these dings or scratches, metaphorically speaking, in the energy field are not healed, they can show up in the physical or emotional realm or psychological realm as symptoms of one sort or another. And so what the shamans do is to actually work in the energy field to heal the imperfections. And that's what the training is basically about, and hence alleviate or reduce the physical or psychological symptoms. So, you know, it sounds kind of far out to an engineer or a scientist, and it is controversial because you can't measure the energy field. But if you read anything about modern science, scientific research, you'll know that if you go down from molecules to atoms to subatomic particles and even further, as they're now doing, the further down you go, the more you discover that virtually everything is just energy. Yep. You know, and little tiny particles swirling around a huge orbit, which is nothing, inside of which is nothing. So the shamans had a good sense of this thousands of years ago. Modern science is just kind of catching up. And it's not unique to shamanism either. Yeah, good, exactly. It's not unique to shamanism. I mean, the Hindus call it prana, the Chinese call it qi, acupuncturists work in energy meridians. So it's not just unique to shamanism or specific to shamanism.
When you were training, it wasn't just sitting down with a textbook, and it wasn't just sitting on a mountain meditating. You were literally brought through the traditions in the Western concept that you could understand, and then you worked. But can you tell us some of the hard things that you had to go through?
Yeah, yes, I can, definitely. the hardest thing was really to be able to sense imperfections in the energy field. And we were told that, yes, you can do that. Now, I had no way of doing that initially. I went through the motions. I couldn't detect anything. But I gradually learned to, and that was just something that we had to do. And then I observed that when imperfections were removed by some of the trainers, that the symptoms that people had were also removed. So it was a lot of just witnessing what was going on and gradually having the disbelief removed. Not so much into belief, but just into acceptance of the possibility. That's really what it boiled down to. And, you know, what's important, I think, is that the client doesn't have to believe in energy fields. They don't have to believe in all this concept, all this mumbo-jumbo, as I once said to one of the trainers in the full class.
Oh, my gosh. And you were kicked out.
I did kind of cringe after I said it, but it got a good laugh. And she was very gracious about it. But the client doesn't have to believe. They just have to have the intention to be healed. So, you know, shamanism is not it's spiritual, but it's not a religion, or at least it's not the kind of religion that requires a creed or a guru or a hierarchy. It's just a spiritual connection.
And when you were in your training, did you have any powerful revelations or anything like the owl? Did you have energy?
Well, yes, I did, as a matter of fact. There was an introductory weekend that I went to. The first thing I did was to go to that after I found out about the school. And I was certainly drawn to it just by the whole process and the simplicity of the process, but I was also skeptical. So I asked one of the trainers, who turned out eventually to be my mentor, if she would do a session on me the following week. And she said, sure. And I said, well, how will we do that? Because I knew she lived in Upper New York State and I live on Cape Cod. And she said, that's not a problem. We'll do it over the phone. And I said, yeah. And she said, sure. Works equally well over the phone. She said she does 90% of her sessions over the phone. So I thought, well, if first of all she can heal me of something, and secondly she can do it over the phone, that's two strikes against my skepticism block, as it were. And sure enough, the following week we had a session over the phone, and she said, what do you want to work on? And I said, well, I'd had restless leg syndrome for about 10 years. That's one of these things. It's not a serious ailment, but what happens is you lie down at night and your legs start twitching and crawling, feeling like ants are running up, and you just have to get up and walk around. And so on and off for a decade, I'd have to get up and walk around for an hour or so every night. And doctors say there's nothing you can do about it except take drugs, and the side effects are often worse than the symptoms you're having. So I hadn't taken the drugs. So she worked on me for about an hour over the phone. I really didn't experience anything. And then she'd said at the end, you know, maybe it'll take a few days before things sink in, because when you make a shift in the energy field, it can take a few days to stick, as it were, in the physical or psychological realm. Sure enough, about a week later, I started sleeping really well. And she'd also told me that I might need a couple of three sessions. And about a month later, I did need to have a second session, but that was in May, 2.5 years ago, and I haven't had restless legs since. So that was one of the most powerful experiences.
Wow.
And certainly convinced me to go ahead with the actual school, the actual sessions. That was just the introductory weekend I'd been to.
So when sessions like that happen, and we'll talk about all the work that you do, do people need to know what was the cause, or just be open to have the energy, let's say block or something, leave? Do you need to say, oh, well, because that?
No, there's really no need to know what's going on. The main thing is just for the student to have the intention to be healed, not the student, the client, to have the intention to be healed. And often, in fact, I will tell the client that you don't have to tell me what your issue or symptom or concern is. It's not like psychotherapy. We don't have to have a long discussion. People can tell me a little bit if they like, but they don't have to. And so often, in some of the examples I'll give you later, I didn't know what the symptom was or the concern was until the client told me at the end of the session or in an email several weeks later.
Brilliant.
And yet the healing can still happen.
Brilliant. Can you just tell us, for people that are listening, if they're interested in the training, where would they learn about like the kind of work that you did to mm-hmm. be able to do
sure,
it?
Sure. Well, you could look at my website as a start, which is www.nhealing.com. That's the first two letters of energy, EN. Somebody else had taken energy healing, so I had to settle for enhealing.com.
Okay.
And you'll find on that a link to the Four Winds Society, which is the school that I train under or with. And they've got all kinds of resources on that website. There's also a couple of useful books. There's a lot of books, actually, are listed on that website. There's a couple I'd recommend initially, I think, for anybody who's interested, and you'll find links to them on my website. But if you don't have access to the internet, I'll just tell you right now, they're both by Alberto Villoldo. That's Villoldo. And one of them is called The Dance of the Four Winds, and the other is called Shaman, Healer, Sage. The first one is about his journeys in Peru as he explored this whole tradition. So it's a little bit like Indiana Jones in a way, because he has lots of exciting experiences, the ones that we didn't have to have in the Western version of the training. And then the second one, Shaman Healer Sage, is really an introduction to the concepts of energy healing. So you can get a good sense of both the background and the current Western version in these two books.
So your website is enhealing.com.
Right.
So what does Four Winds mean or represent?
The Four Winds gets back to the tradition, which is common to the Native American Indians and to Peru and also many cultures, that there is a belief that each of the four directions or each of the four winds has significance. And in fact, in Peru, there's an archetype for each of the four winds, an animal or a bird. And this is used in many different ways, but one example is, and I'll tell you what the archetypes are in a minute, but one example is for the purpose of opening sacred space. Because the concept here is that you don't have to be in church to be in a sacred space. You don't have to be in a sacred building. You can create your own sacred space wherever you are. And in order to do that, you have a little invocation in which you call on the four winds and the earth, Pachamama, Mother Earth, as they call it, and spirit above, Great Spirit, God, the higher power, in order to create this sacred space for the duration of whatever you're going to do there, like a healing session or a fire ceremony or whatever. And the archetypes of the four winds in Peru, they vary, of course, with the different traditions. But in Peru, the archetype of the south wind is serpent, which some of us would probably squirm at, but serpent is the archetype of both connection with the mother. She slithers on her belly on the Mother Earth all the time. She also sheds her skin in one fell swoop periodically. And so she's a sort of exhortation to us, an example to us of shedding our past completely so that we can move forward, focusing on where we are right now rather than being stuck in the past. Mm-hmm. The archetype of the west wind is Jaguar, as I mentioned earlier. And Jaguar is both an impeccable tracker who can help us to stimulate us, as it were, to find all the things that are imperfections or holding us back and therefore enable us to clear them. And Jaguar is also fearless. So he or she is the archetype of traveling beyond the worlds, beyond death. The archetype of the north wind or the north direction is hummingbird, Siwakinti in the dialect of Peru. And hummingbird, this little migrator that travels, 600 or 800 miles across the Gulf of Mexico twice a year, little half-ounce bundle of feathers, is the archetype of courage. Teaches us to apply courage and optimism, its courage and optimism, to the journeys of our souls. And also teaches us to sip all the nectar we can possibly manage from every flower we pass along the way. You know, be here now kind of thing. And then finally, the archetype of the east wind is condor in South America, or eagle up here. And its message really is to help us to soar with spirit, to really soar to the heights, to fly wingtip to wingtip with spirit, as they say, to see beyond the mountains, to see the place of our becoming. And also with this magnificent eyesight, to see everything along the way that we need to see. So it's not just focused on the path, but also on the present and what we're doing. So those are the archetypes, and we call on them to open sacred space, and then we thank them afterwards to close sacred space after a ceremony or after a healing. So every time I do a healing in my office, for example, I open sacred space for the session or the day, and then close it afterwards.
That's awesome.
It's really very beautiful.
This is Organic Thinking Radio. I'm Michelle, and we are talking about shamanism, and my guest today is Don Cameron. And Don is a shamanic energy healer, and we're going deep. You're teaching us a lot. This is incredible. So can you start to tell us, so now you're here on Cape Cod, which is exciting that we have a local shaman. If people are coming to see you in your practice and what you do, what are some of the things that you offer? And can you tell us about like people that have come to you before? Do they know about shamanism? Do they say, well, I know what I want. Can you do this? Or they say, I'm having this problem. Can you help me? How do people find you?
Sure. Most people don't know about it unless they've got a friend who's experienced it themselves. So usually they're coming to me because they're interested. I mean, they've heard about this. They've heard that maybe there's something here. Maybe they've been through psychotherapy for years and years and years and are not getting anywhere with it, or they're just frustrated with the pace. maybe they have problems that they just don't want to talk to anybody about. And one of the sweet things about this kind of practice is, as I say, you don't have to tell anybody, you don't have to tell the shaman about your issues if you don't want to. So people come to me with a whole range of issues. I may not know what they are at the beginning, but afterwards I usually find out. And they can be anything from depression, apathy, anxiety, to some physical symptoms like my restless leg syndrome, all the way to alcoholism and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Although that's not common yet in my own practice, but certainly other shamans have treated those kind of symptoms very successfully. Let me give you a few examples that might make this more real. One person recently came to me, and she didn't tell me at the time, but I certainly found out afterwards, and I could sense that her problem was that she was wired. I mean, she was just the image of anxiety and totally wired. And she told me afterwards that not only did she feel wired, but she also felt or had felt that she really was only in her head. She never really felt connected to her body. She never really felt grounded on the earth. And at the end of the session, I usually ask people to sit up on the edge of the massage table I use, not because I touch, but just because a massage table is more comfortable than the floor and you need to be able to recline. And so I ask them to sit up at the end and just sort of drop into what they're feeling for a few minutes to see if there's anything that grows in them as a good feeling. And no sooner had I finished saying that than she jumped off the table and planted herself on the floor with her feet really far apart and her hands on her hips. And I said, I was kind of puzzled. I said, did you hear what I just asked you to do? She said, oh yeah, I'm doing it. She said, I feel totally grounded for the first time I can ever remember. She said, it's an awesome feeling. I really feel that I'm connected to the earth. So that was very sweet. I mean, how it worked, don't ask me, but although I'll give you some theory in a minute, or hypothesis. Another person, a guy, he's an administrator for a hospital, which is part of a big chain. And he came to me, didn't tell me what the problem was till later, but 3 months later he sent me an email and he said, you know, my problem was that this chain has been imposing all kinds of reorganizations and downsizing, which he said, I understand in this economic climate, but the way they were doing it was all wrong. And he said, I got so mad at them, I just could hardly even think. I was causing migraines. I was just totally clutched up with this anger all the time. He said, after your session, a few days later, he said, the anger just drained away. He said, I'm still pissed off at them up there, but he said, I don't get consumed by it all the time. So the anger left him, the emotional anger left him. The rational anger stayed, but not the emotional anger. Another one, a woman who, as she told me later, had severe abuse as a child from both parents. And she said, at the end of the session, she said she had the sweetest image of being hugged by her mother. And she said, I never remember that actually happening in reality. But she said, I had the sweetest image of it during the session. It was the most blessed kind of a feeling. And finally, of course, my own restless leg syndrome was another example of a different realm. So there's some wonderful things can happen, but we can't always predict it. And that's something I should talk about for a minute, because otherwise I don't want people to get the feeling that all they've got to do is come to me and sort of magical things will happen. They may, but there's no way we can actually predict it. And the reason for that is that I mentioned that shamanism is a very spiritual practice, but without some of the trappings of many religions. And basically the shamans believe, as do many other belief systems, that we're all connected. We're all part of the one. We're all part of God, Great Spirit, a higher power, however you like to think about it. And so I think the way this works is that sometimes as we go through life, our connection to the one, our connection to spirit, as we call it in this tradition, can get kind of crimped down a bit. So we no longer have a free flow of healing energy coming from spirit to us. And I think what the shaman does somehow, I don't know how he does it or how we do it, but somehow the shaman kind of opens up that connection a bit, opens the door. Maybe we're just door openers, but we kind of open the door a bit or widen the connection a bit so that whatever healing is appropriate between spirit and the client is going to happen. And it is really, that's what we were taught, that it's whatever healing is appropriate, that we can't predict it because we don't do the healing. We simply open the door. And so, you know, it's a very relaxing kind of process because the client and the shaman both have to have the intention that healing will occur, but the client and the shaman both have to surrender to the the not knowing of exactly what will happen.
And it's almost like a more of a blessing in the sense of if you're getting the energy work done, you don't have to fear, well, what if too much energy comes? Or what if they do something and then I change? Because it isn't. It's really what your own spirit is needing. It's never invasive.
Yep. People have sometimes said to me, they've heard that somehow energy healing can cause a tumor to grow or something like that. I've never heard of that. And we don't direct energy at a tumor in any way. In fact, we don't claim to cure cancer, for one thing. But we certainly don't direct energy at any particular part of the body. We simply open the door and ask for whatever healing is appropriate to occur. So it cannot be dangerous in that way.
And every single person is individual in what they need. If they have an energy block or the energy needs, it's not like it's just a one shop stop. Oh, you have that. That means this.
Exactly. And in fact, it's interesting because we can't predict. We're taught to stand aside from the outcome, to not have a stake in the outcome. And I had a beautiful example of that recently. I volunteer at hospice here on the Cape on Sundays. And recently I was called in by a family to see if I could give a little session to their mother. Now, we call it Reiki at hospice, which is also another healing modality. So I don't bring in rattles or anything like that. But it's the same kind of thing. It's just focusing on energy healing to happen. And so the elderly woman, the mother, was, as they say, actively dying, which is a strange way to put it, but she was in the final stages. She'd been comatose for hours, according to the grown-up kids who were there, three adult women. And they said, would I please give a session to their mother? So I was simply standing behind her bed with my hands on the pillow, not touching her, just a few inches away from her head. And I caught myself intending that she should have a peaceful passing. And I said, wait a minute, to myself, that's not what I should be doing. I'm supposed to be intending that whatever healing is appropriate will happen. Mm. So I started focusing on that instead. And within a very short time, this dying woman raised her hand and stretched it out towards her three daughters on the other side of the room. And of course, the three daughters jumped up, came over, held their mother's hand, sobbing. I left the room, of course, right away. And about an hour later, they came out and they thanked me profusely. And I said, well, I didn't do anything. I was only there a few minutes. And they said, but you don't realize she'd been comatose for hours. She said, somehow we got another chance to say goodbye. Mm. So that was very sweet.
Yeah. You're holding the space.
Holding the space and just intending that whatever was appropriate should happen without forcing my own intention on it, my own detailed intention on it.
Brilliant. So we're talking about shamanism here on Organic Thinking, and Don Cameron, who is our shamanic energy healer here on Cape Cod, is sharing some information. And you can reach Don at enhealing.com, www.enhealing.com. So on your website, you talk about kind of specific things that you do as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
People can come in and you start them with one thing and it leads to other things, or can they pick and choose certain modalities?
Well, initially we don't pick and choose. Initially we have one specific session, one specific procedure. And then afterwards we may jointly, at subsequent sessions, we may jointly decide, we being the shaman and the client jointly, what to do next.
Okay.
So yeah, there's a little bit of picking and choosing after the first session. But the first one is always what we call the illumination process. And that is just a very simple process. The client simply lies on the massage table or the floor, focuses on what healing is desired. We often talk about what kind of an issue makes sense. I won't get into that now. And the shaman then identifies which chakra is affected. Now, chakras are these little spirals of energy that connect the energy field to the physical body. They're, again, not unique to shamanism. Hindus have talked about them for thousands of years as well. But there are seven major chakras that connect the energy field to the spine. And so we figure out which of these chakras is affected, and then unwind the chakra and ask the client to place a stone that they've picked and charged up with the energy of their issue just by blowing into it on the chakra. And then we just see what happens. And after a while, the client may experience nothing, as I did during my initial session, my restless leg session, or they may have some moving experiences. They may visualize themselves being hugged, as I mentioned earlier. Sometimes there's some kind of catharsis. One woman just broke into floods of tears lying on the table. because she recalled the birth of her first child 40 years before, which she'd blocked out because of a traumatic birthing experience and hadn't been able to recover for 40 years of on and off therapy. Or they may have electrical feelings moving in their body, simple tingles or twitches, but sometimes that can help us to identify things and move them. And then once we're satisfied that nothing much else is happening, we simply take the stone off that chakra, illuminate it, hence the name of the process, by bringing down energy from my eighth chakra, which we conceive of as being the connection between our energy field and spirit, and kind of giving that chakra that we've been working on a dose of pure energy from spirit, wind up the chakra again, and then have the person sit up at the end of the session, on the end of the table, and just drop into whatever they're feeling, as I mentioned earlier. And sometimes people can have all kinds of positive feelings. The woman I mentioned who jumped off the table instantly and felt totally grounded. Another woman who, as she told me later, had been her issue had been apathy, just complete, utter apathy. She just had no kind of get up and go at all. And her experience was euphoria. I mean, she had an almost mystical experience, which she described to me in detail. We wouldn't stop, you know, I just couldn't stop her bubbling over. Another one was a young woman who had just had her first child recently. And she just was, she was wired in a different way. She was just very nervous about being a mother and didn't think she was doing it right, was worried about every little thing that her child had wrong, 2 or 3 months old. And at the end of the session, I said, "How are you feeling?" And she said, "Exhaustion." And I said, "Is that a good feeling?" And she said, "Oh, you wouldn't believe how good a feeling it is." She said, "I haven't been able to sleep soundly for ages." She said, "I feel like I could just go to sleep for hours right now." So somehow it had taken the edge off totally from what she was feeling. Another woman had, who had been the victim of a lot of abuse in her childhood, and she said she suddenly got during the session, I say got kind of in quotes because it was, wasn't clear how it came through, but she suddenly got that somehow got that her parents had been victims of abuse themselves in their childhood. And all of a sudden she realized that it was that that had caused them in turn to do the abuse on her, and she said her feeling of bitterness and victimhood changed into one of compassion for her parents, which she was just so grateful for. Completely changed attitude.
So this work would be good for people that are having, they can't put their finger on what the problem is, mm-hmm. or if they do know, they, you know, they have a reoccurring trauma that they keep thinking about or reliving. Maybe they don't want to go to a psychiatrist or something like that because they don't literally don't want to relive it or keep, yep. or talk about it. But this, you don't. You just have to sit within your own self,
yep.
and the energy is
realigned. That's absolutely
realigned.
Right. Yep. I'll mention also, though, that just from what you just said, I do a lot of work with a nurse practitioner in Hyannis who has a practice whose patients are people with multiple traumas in their past. And also substance abuse problems. And she refers people to me frequently. And she finds that my work somehow takes the edge off what they're doing, what they're experiencing, and enables them to be more open to the kind of talk therapy and substitute medication that she prescribes for them. Mm. And when I talked to her about that recently and asked her how she thought that worked, she said she thought it was basically that they were accessing their own inner healers. Which is kind of like another way of saying my opening the door and widening the connection to spirit. But the point is, people can be in therapy and find my kind of work as something that is complementary to it because it can accelerate the therapy that may have been stuck,
yes.
which often happens.
Brilliant.
In fact, there was one guy I'll mention that comes to mind who was referred to me by this nurse practitioner. And we did an extraction on him, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But afterwards, when he sat up at the end, I said, "How do you feel?" And he said, "I just feel kind of sad, like there's something missing." And I said, "Well, that's okay. You know, that's the way it is. I can't change what you feel." I was hoping he'd do something more positive. Anyway, about a week later, his therapist, this nurse practitioner, called me, and she said she just had a follow-up session with him, and he had explained something that he hadn't told her before. She knew that he'd been blocked in some way. He had been making good progress, and then he'd kind of stalled. And she didn't know why, and he couldn't tell her why. And he told her that the reason why he thought now that he'd been blocked was that he'd been obsessing about getting back in touch with an old girlfriend that he'd broken up with 2 or 3 years before. It had been a toxic situation. He knew it was the right thing to do to break up with her. But he had been he'd been obsessing about getting back in touch to the extent of actually making detailed plans about how he was going to apologize and what they were going to do. And he said after my session, a few days later, he said he suddenly realized what was missing. It was his obsession. Mm. And now he's making good progress again, because that one is just let go. Now, we didn't talk about that. He didn't tell me anything about this.
The energy cords to the other person were
dissolved. Yeah, exactly. Oh. And in fact, that's the second process that we do is called an extraction, as I mentioned that I did for him. And the concept there is that we sometimes have what we call intrusions in our energy field, energetic intrusions, which can be attachments to past relationships, as in this particular case, or they can be because of traumas, or they can be deceased loved ones, I mean, connections to deceased loved ones, all kinds of possibilities. The indigenous shamans talk about them in really colorful terms. They say, you know, they can detect an axe stuck in your energy field, or a spear, or an arrow, or a chain around you. I don't think we necessarily have to do that. Maybe some shamans can. But we can learn to track in the energy field just by running your hand about an inch or two above the body and start to feel little tingles, twitches, whatever. I couldn't feel anything when I started. My rational mind was saying, this is mumbo jumbo again. There's no way that I'm going to ever be able to do this. But I finally, or eventually, not finally, but eventually over the years, got the hang of it. And now I can actually detect when there's something stuck in the energy field and remove it. And when I do, sometimes I know what it is, not always, but there's usually some kind of shift that occurs in the client when I do so.
You know, even in our society, we say things like, oh, I feel you stabbed me in the back,
mm-hmm.
or,
mm-hmm.
you know, something's caught in my throat. Yep. So we already speak energy terms anyways.
Yes, we do.
So you wouldn't necessarily be working on somebody and you see a knife and you pull it out, but you would see
you would feel a fragment or something. Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
We don't always know what it is. There was one client I had who was a young woman who lived in Manhattan, and she was up here for a while. And during her session, I just sensed there were a bunch of things stuck in her upper chest. I couldn't tell what they were, but the closest analogy would be a bunch of porcupine quills. It's probably how the shamans would have described it. I didn't feel them as quills, but I just kept pulling out more and more handfuls of stuff. And she's got her eyes closed. She didn't know what I was doing. But as I was doing this, every time I pulled out more, her smile grew and grew and grew until by the end she had this broad smile from ear to ear. And afterwards I said to her, what was that like? And she said, I don't know what you were doing, but she said it felt absolutely wonderful. And she sent me an email about 3 or 4 weeks later, and she explained that her problem had been, I didn't know this at the time, just chronic depression. Part of it was exaggerated or exacerbated by the fact she happened to be living with her mother in a tiny little apartment in New York City and working in a job that meant she was always coming home at night in the dark and just feeling sad and lonely and miserable. And she said, one of the steps that I ask people to do at the end of the session when they sit up on the side of the table and drop into whatever they're feeling is to see if they can express that feeling without words. So they can, maybe with a gesture or a movement or a sound or an image maybe, so that if they can do that, so that they can recapture that feeling later by going through the same motion or gesture, say. And she was probably the best example I've had of somebody who told me afterwards, she said, I really worked for about a week at remembering that every day, recalling that feeling every day. And it was, I had to work at it for a week, but she said, after that week, it became second nature to me. All I had to do was just remember, and the feeling came back to me. And she said, now when I walk through the dark streets at night in New York City and I'm miserable and cold and depressed, she said, all I have to do is recall that feeling. And she said, it's like I can step up onto a little platform inside me and the sadness just drains away.
Mm.
It was very sweet. So she was able to keep it with her, which was nice.
Like she can call her power at
exactly.
any time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So the session, you go in and you get what you call illumination.
Illumination is the initial process, right.
Okay. And then during the illumination, that's when you can do the extractions or whatever
exactly.
needs to be done.
You can do that as part of the illumination, or you can do it in a subsequent session. And soul retrievals are probably the most interesting intellectual experience. The other two I just mentioned are more energetic experiences. But soul retrieval, the third process, is both energetic and intellectual, I think. And the concept there is that as we go through life and things happen to us, whether they're relatively minor traumas, like maybe a mild fender bender or breaking up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, or major ones like any of the life traumas you can have, all the way up to post-traumatic stress from a Humvee being blown up or a little girl or boy being abused, that a piece of our soul may go into hiding, as we say. And psychologists call this dissociation. The shamans talk about it as soul loss or partial soul loss. You don't lose your whole soul. You just lose a splinter of it. And we can, in fact, lose many splinters of our souls. But the belief here is that they're not really lost. They've just gone into hiding. They're not accessible to us. And what the shaman can do is to, we call it journeying, go down into essentially the collective subconscious, although shamans talk about it in mythic terms of going down to the underworld and asking the guardian of the underworld to let us in, and to look at the chambers of the person's soul. And when we do that, we can often bring back several things. Sometimes the piece of the soul that was lost, which in a soldier's case might be his courage, in the little girl's case might be her innocence. And we also may be able to bring back, amongst other things, a power animal for the person who can then be an ally for the individual. And for example, the power animals are often what you might expect to be power animals, you know, wolves or bears or eagles or hawks. But sometimes they're rather strange. And I had a couple of great examples recently. One of them was a limpet. And I asked this limpet when it presented itself in my little internal journey, I said, what's your medicine for this person? And you know what a limpet is. It's these conical shells that stick to the rock so hard you've more or less got to use a hammer and chisel to get them off. And it said to me in my journey, it said its medicine for the person was to help her stick with whatever she set her mind to. Not stick to, but stick with. So when I brought that back to her and told her, she said, that's perfect. She said, I have so many ideas going on. I start things, I never finish them. Because as soon as I start something, I get another idea and I want to go off on that track. And I said, well, now you've got this little limpet inside you because I brought it back for you. She said, how does that work? And I said, you just call on it whenever you need to stick with something you're in the middle of and want to keep going with. I said, I don't know how it works, but the more you ask for help from it, the more you call on it, the more it will help. And the other sweet example was the guy was a Marine, ex-Marine, a vet from, I think it was Desert Storm, the original Iraq situation. And his power animal that I brought back for him was a frog, an equally surprising power animal. And I said to the little frog in my journey, I said, what's your medicine? And it said to remind him of the fable that inside many a frog is a prince. And I said to myself, well, that's kind of trite, but I've learned never to challenge it. I always bring him back as I hear them. So I told him this, and he almost teared up. This is a swarthy guy, ex-Marine, you know, big, muscular, shaven head. And he said, look at me. He said, I'm kind of scary, right? And I said, well, I could see you could be to some people. He said, oh, yes, I am, believe me. He said, that's all people can see in me is my scariness. And I said, well, this little frog is now inside you. And whenever you, and the point was, he said, all they can see is my scariness. And what they can't see is the empathy and tenderness I feel inside of me that I'm trying to project. I said, well, the frog's going to help you do that. He said, how? And I said, I don't know how. Just ask for it. Next time you meet a woman you want to form a relationship with, ask the frog for help. And somehow it will help you to project that empathy and tenderness. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, you can't make these things up. You know, well, I shouldn't say you can't make them up, but you can't predict them. Let's put it that way.
Right. So that is the soul retrieval.
Finding the pieces of the person. Exactly.
Incredible.
It's a sweet process.
When you are trained to be a shaman and you're given all these tools, can you do things like, you know, if there's bad energy in a house or something, go and work with houses and places? And
yeah, that
land?
Happens. I don't get much of a call for that, but sometimes a client will complain that their house just feels bad in some way, or some parts of it seems to give them bad feelings, even if they don't think it's actually haunted. And what we can do is we can clear a space of what we think of as negative or heavy energy. And we do that just by going in there, opening sacred space, as I described before, calling on the four winds and Pachamama, Mother Earth, and Great Spirit to kind of create that little temporary church, if you like. And then we clear the space with sage, which is, you know, ancient tradition for the Native American Indians as well as the Peruvians, and maybe a crystal. And, you know, when we started, I was thinking, sage and crystals, what's all this about? Especially beautiful quartz crystals that we're supposed to buy for the training. And I asked one of the trainers, I said, you know, do shamans in the jungle or the Andes, can they really afford an expensive quartz crystal? And, of course, the answer was, no, of course they can't afford it, but they don't need it. They're shamans for generations. We just use these things as training wheels, was the way they put it. You know, we have to satisfy our linear mind somehow. And so we just use them as training wheels until we finally get the idea of being able, like some of the native shamans can do, of just pointing a finger at somebody and they're healed without going through all the steps of a process. A process is so Western, but that's why the training is, you know, is designed that way, because it appeals to our Western minds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess when you're doing the house, it's, again, it's like the body. If there's blocked energy or trapped energy or stagnant energy.
I think it's more like intrusions. It's more like, you know, entities, if you like, hanging around that have been trapped there, like attachments, if you like, that you can just release, send back to Pachamama or spirit. Yep.
Wow. Yep. So with your work, people can get a hold of you from your website mainly.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's www.enhealing.com. And then you do your work, you do the eliminations, the extractions, the soul retrieval, and now we're talking about even, you know, helping the energy of a house or people passing on.
That's the tradition, another traditional thing that the shamans talk about, helping the dying cross over between the worlds. And there is a Western version of that. There's a set of procedures called the death rites, and some of these can be done by anybody. For a loved one, you don't have to be a shaman to do them. And in fact, I recommend that your listeners, if they're interested in this, take a look at another website, which is www.dyingconsciously.org. All one word, Dying Consciously. It's also linked to from the Four Winds Society and from my website. And there's a beautiful description of the processes that people can carry out with their own loved ones without any training. We could spend an hour on this, but just briefly, there's a couple of them that are not unique to shamanism. One of them is sort of a life review. We call it recapitulation and forgiveness. And it's a guided way for the dying person to consider things like, what do you wish you'd done in this life but didn't or not done? Who would you like to forgive? Who would you like to say I love you to? And also granting permission to the loved one to die. And, you know, these are things that people are often aware of, but they don't often do them consciously or deliberately. And as a result, the dying person can often be kind of held back. And if we help them by doing these things deliberately, it often can be a very sweet release of the dying person to just go on the path and not be stuck here in whatever miserable state they're in because of their end-stage disease or whatever they've got wrong with them.
Helping set them free.
Yeah, exactly. There are some other procedures that require a trained shaman that are also described on that website I mentioned, and I'm going to be offering these soon.
Brilliant. And also, I just have to say how I first met you. You were doing a talk in Wellfleet, and they had a sign that said, Shamanic Healing Talk, 3 o'clock, so-and-so date. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like the words on the board were 9 feet wide. It just literally came out at me, and mm-hmm. I thought, oh, I think I need to go see that. And, you know, had it on my calendar. What usually went the place that you did the talk, you know, there's, 30, 40 people there. So I thought, well, I'll get there maybe 3 minutes before the talk, 5 minutes. I got there. The place was so packed. It was like a rock concert. There, all of the parking lots in the whole area, there were people parked on the grass. I went in. It was standing room only. I think I counted 150 people in this small place. And I thought, wow, this is pretty, not only are you the real deal, what you're talking about, people are really ready to embrace and have been waiting for that. And the way that you, again, the idea of the Western shaman, if we had somebody up there with long hair and feathers and, you know, talking in a different language, I don't think it would have affected the people, but you're speaking brilliantly. It makes sense to the Western mind, like you say, and then you also you're carrying that energy. I think it's fabulous.
So I have to laugh and interrupt you because one of the other people who was there said that told me through a friend that when she'd been a little nervous about coming because she was expecting somebody in porcupine quills or feathers.
There you go.
But she said when she walked in, she said, I saw this guy who looked like a Catholic priest.
Right.
I'd never been called that before, but I guess it made her feel better.
Yes, this is the next level.
Right.
So I talked to you and I said, now can you do a group healing, because we have groups of people here that are, you know, they're very interested, and there's gatherings of women. And you said, well, I won't do a group healing, but I will do a despacho ceremony. Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left, so can you describe what you performed for all of us? And it was pretty pretty amazing as well, I have
sure.
to add.
Well, very briefly, yes, a despacho is like a Tibetan mandala. If you've seen the Tibetan monks making a beautiful mandala out of individual colored sand grains and spending literally weeks over it and then finally pouring it into the harbor or wherever they dispose of it. And the despacho is the same kind of idea, but instead of colored sand grains, we make them with all kinds of natural items that each have some significance. So things like salt for the ocean. In the tradition, the ocean is called Mama Kocha, for the mother of the waters. Sugar for sweetness, corn for sustenance, whatever we have available to us. And the idea is that it's a tradition of offering our gratitude to the earth and to spirit and making our wishes, whether they're personal wishes or global wishes for mankind or the earth, and offering these gratitudes, these prayers up to spirit. And so as we create this thing like a mandala, we also, each person blows their individual prayers into a little cluster of leaves that we then place in the despacho. In Peru, the leaves are coca leaves, but they're not terribly available up here, so we use bay leaves instead, but it's the same idea. And then after we finished, we wrap this bundle up in paper, and we take it to a fire, a ceremonial fire, usually at the full moon or a new moon. And in the same kind of way the Tibetan monks would just pour their sand grain mandala into the waters of the Piton Harbor, instead, we burn the despacho in a ceremonial fire and thus return both its contents and the prayers to Pachamama and Great Spirit.
Yeah, it's amazing. Very, very, very special. If anyone out there would like to get a hold of Don, you can find him through the website, which is www.enhealing.com, or the email is don@enhealing.com. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then also, I think you're going to be doing more of the ceremonies, if you'd like to be part of the
yep.
ceremonies, perhaps email.
Let me know. Mm-hmm. And I should also mention that my office is on 6A at the Orleans Brewster line. Mm-hmm. I'm also giving sessions at the spa at Chatham Bars Inn, which is a beautiful place. And you can ask them about combination packages of energy healings and massage or skin treatments. And you can even get gift certificates from me, which might be a nice thing to do if you're interested, but you're not quite sure you're ready for an energy session yourself, but you maybe would like to give it to somebody that you know, and then you can find out how it was for them. So there's an alternative at the holiday season. I'll also make house calls in the Cape area, and I can do this work over the phone, as was done to me in my very first session, my restless leg session.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming on Organic Thinking. And again, we here at WMR are heard all around the world. As well as the Cape and Islands. So if you'd like to have a phone session, like you said, with Don, I guess the best way is the enhealing.com mm-hmm. or don@enhealing.com. So shamanism, wow, what a great show. So thank you very much for coming on, Don. And perhaps in the spring you can come on and give us more ideas and details to go on our own journeys.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you'd like to get a hold of me, I am at michelle@organicthinkingradio.com. Have a great couple of weeks. I'll talk to you very soon.